everything car seats. This week we're talking car seats, all different types of car seats.
Maybe you have a baby and you need a special heightened seat, or maybe you're just a person who appreciates the finer things and wants something made of satin.
We get a lot of emails from people thinking that this is just about baby car seats, and
of course, it's not just that.
No, and frankly, I'm kind of offended.
You're a little bit narrow-minded if you think just that.
Yeah,
there's a lot of things to consider.
Yeah.
Cheek spatialing, thigh caressing.
That's right, yeah, thigh warmth.
There's a whole new trend of odor, aroma therapy-oriented car seats that we're really excited about. We wish someone would ask us about that.
Yeah, Will took me for a ride in his this weekend, and I thought it was very lovely.
You said odor aroma therapy?
Yep.
Usually they drop the odor and they just say aromatherapy.
Not in this industry.
I'm sorry, you're kicked off this podcast. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
This is a zero criticism safe space.
Yeah, you were talking a lot about baby seats before we started recording. Well, maybe if you get some odor aromatherapy car seats, you'll learn to be in a more chilled out state of mind. Mm-hmm. There's some lovely lilac and spring breeze.
Yeah, there's also scented odor aroma. Aromatherapy.
Normally they're odorless. But the scented odor aromatherapies actually have odors.
Usually it's just packed inside. Like the interior has a scent, and you know that it has a scent. You can't smell it.
Right. It's blocked from you, but you know it's there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hi, this is the UCB Long Form Conversations podcast.
That's right. Sitting to my left is John Frusciante.
And sitting to my right, it took me a second to figure that out, is Will Hines.
And both of our rights is this episode's guest, Mr. Benjamin Apple. Hello, Benjamin.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
We also, as always, have our podcast intern, Sypha Sounds.
Hello. Good evening.
And a surprise guest in the off-mic podcast intern's intern today is Veronica Yurovsky. Mm-hmm. And she is off-mic.
Mm-hmm. Where she belongs.
Yes, where the podcast intern traditionally sits.
Mm-hmm.
Say hello kind of loudly, Veronica.
Hello.
Mm. There you go.
That's going to be...
Lean in there and say hi.
Hello.
There you go.
Well, boy.
Sypha's
the
disdain
audio engineer.
Is palpable.
Why are you letting interns talk?
We're growing soft in our older years. Benjamin.
Hi, Benjamin.
Hey, guys.
Do we want to talk about what just happened right before?
Yeah, before we started recording this episode.
It's a podcast first.
Sure. I was sitting right where I am right now, and Nate Dern kind of sidled into the room and slyly showed me his iPhone, and he'd written a note that said, "Do you want to be on the Herald team, the regulars?" Just in case I
said no, right?
And in case I didn't know that the regulars were a Herald team.
Oh, right.
You want to be on the Herald team, the regulars.
Yeah.
And that happened moments before we started recording.
Yeah,
you got a big smile on your face right as we were about to hit record.
Yeah, perfect.
Pretty cool.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
By the time this airs, that will already be public knowledge, but we want to be the first to congratulate
you. Yeah, it was kind of fun. So what do you think about being on the regulars? What's your time on that team been like?
Since I was put on the team, I haven't even spoken
to my
teammates.
Wow,
that's
too bad. Sounds...
You're getting the gossip here first, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm really excited about it. It's a great team, and
they're an amazing team. Yeah, and they're kind of your buds, and that's really cool that's working out.
I'm very psyched about it.
Replacing Phil Jackson, who is going off to write for Key and Peele.
Yeah. Which I didn't even know that he was like in the running for that.
I didn't either.
Phil just put on Facebook, was like, "Oh, I'm moving to LA to write for Key and Peele." It's like, you write? I mean, the dude's
like,
super talented and funny. I'm not saying that, but I just didn't know that he was even in the running for stuff.
He seems to me like a guy who plays things close
yeah,
to the
Yeah, exactly.
Best
it does. Like, yes, I agree.
He has things going on. You wouldn't necessarily know about them.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It doesn't surprise me that he would get that job or that would have been true.
Sure. But we're used to kind of having a mental list of who might get what.
That's right.
Right.
And then you feel a little... confirmed every time one of the people you think might get something gets something.
Mm-hmm.
So you start
Casey's
to think
right
that you kind of see everything.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you argued with him a lot on Facebook about that.
I don't believe this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I tried to take him to task.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Phil Jackson's also an incredibly even-tempered and positive person to an infuriating degree.
Yeah.
He's so emotionally well-balanced that I find him intimidating in almost every way.
Really?
Yeah.
That you...
When I'm around Phil, I'm like, I got to get my act together. This dude, he's just so nice.
Mm-hmm.
And he just, I don't know him actually super well, but he certainly seems like a very centered and just like nice dude.
Absolutely.
Who does not get caught up in the sort of like insecurity storm that goes with, kind of an acting, writing career.
Yeah.
I admire him for it, and I'm intimidated.
How are you in that respect, Benjamin? How would you describe yourself temperament-wise or...
In terms of how I like things I get caught up in?
Or, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I get caught up in things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I try not to, and then other times I give myself license to, because I think that sometimes it's good to be a little scared or self-conscious just as a motivator.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think there are areas where it's helpful to be self-conscious and areas where you have to try to eliminate it.
So you find that you use that when there are times when you get caught up in that feeling, you use it as kind of a motivator to push you to work harder or be better?
I don't find that I'm constantly comparing myself to my immediate peers. I find that I'm comparing myself to my idols, which it might be better because it means you don't have competitive feelings with your personal friends, but it's also worse because you're just cherry picking the best of the best.
Yeah, it's impossible, right?
At my age, this person had done X, Y, Z.
Yeah,
right.
At my age, the outlier, absolute top achiever did this.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough.
So I always try to keep track of a couple of losers to make me feel better, you know?
I do. Well, one thing I do is I pick a couple people who got started really late in life.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm way ahead of that person.
Do you know who mine was in that regard? Was the guitarist for The Police.
Okay.
Andy Summer.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was like 40 years old when he joined The Police.
Hmm.
Yeah. I mean, he'd already been like a really successful session musician.
Right.
And had a good life. But I was always like... Yeah, but now I'm 43, so I can't even compare myself to him. I need like a 50-year-old bass player for like Foreigner or something like that.
Well, go ahead.
I was wrong once because sometimes I'll kind of selectively shield myself from facts to make myself feel better. So for a while, I had myself convinced that Woody Allen was a guy who got a late start in life. Because I was like, well, by the time he was like directing his first film, he was in his like late 30s. Uh-huh. And then I mentioned to someone and they were like, no, dude, he was writing for TV like in high school. Like, he dropped out of high school because he was getting jokes in the newspaper and then on TV at like 16 and 17.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I can't think about Woody Allen
anymore. Don't compare yourself to Woody Allen, except maybe in terms of emotional balance.
Right.
Yeah.
George Bernard Shaw got started late in life, right?
How late?
I think, maybe I'm wrong about that, but I feel like I always heard that he started writing plays later in life.
All right, great. Good for him.
I'll try to confirm that by the end of this podcast, even though somebody listening to this is already like, no, you're wrong.
Right, right. Well, you're right, audience member. Well, Benjamin, let's talk about you here. You are, I'll try to do a little UCB bio maybe, then you can kind of correct me and round me out.
Cool.
So you are a guy who's been around the scene here at UCB for a while, and you were a student and you took a million improv classes. And you were on a million indie teams. We'll talk about some of them.
What year did you start coming around here?
I first went to UCB and started seeing shows in late 2006, and I started my first class in March of 2007.
Okay.
And we'll talk about that. To me, you were kind of with like a new generation of people. I think almost, I mean, in a way, well, we'll talk about that, but a bunch of people who are still around and kind of like big figures in the scene all came in around the same time as you, and you guys were all in teams together.
Mm-hmm.
You were on a Herald Night, or sorry, Mod Night with Onassis. Were they your first?
Yep, first and only mod team.
Yeah, hugely not Gramps.
Right.
Yeah, really early. Yeah. Yeah. Huge, towering team on the, UCB mod. Well, I meant more like stature
lanky
and quality. Well, like that might also be true. There are some lankabouts.
Yeah, certainly height. Yeah. Height and quality.
As well as just doing a lot of cool independent projects. And then on the Herald team, you were on Deckard at first, right?
And Deckard.
And then Bucky.
Yeah.
And then you wrote for Fallon for a while, which just recently ended, sort of somewhat recently.
Yeah, a couple months ago.
Mm-hmm. And now, just as of moments ago, back on the Herald team, the regulars. And you've been like coaching and stuff like that and doing the things that like a veteran tends to do in this scene.
Directing mod teams as well, right? Mm-hmm.
Lots of cool videos. A lot of stuff to cover. Mm-hmm. And just in general, Benjamin, I just think you're an interesting fellow, sort of a cerebral, analytical type. When I first met you, I was sure that you disliked me. And then I asked someone who had taught you a level before. I don't even remember who this was. Who'd you take 301 with?
Joe Engert.
Okay, yeah. And Joe's like, oh, no, Benjamin loves it. But Benjamin is in deep. He just has like a He just has kind of like a deadpan expression.
Yeah. There was never a time when I did not like you. Starting from the point that I met you.
Made me doubt it just a little bit.
But also, Will, isn't that on your business card? When I first met you, I thought you disliked me.
Yeah, I have that. I have that feeling about a lot of people.
but to be fair, a lot of people have that feeling about me. It might be 50-50 when you say it to me, but when anybody says it to me, it's at least 50% me.
Yeah.
Because I've had close friends say that when they first met me, they either thought that I was an all-around dick or they thought that I specifically didn't like them.
Yeah.
It's an ongoing process in my life to keep that from happening.
No. I just what I later learned to appreciate about you, which is just sort of like a really like interesting and unique viewpoint, and you just sort of consider things. A lot of people just kind of steamroll ahead with their first reactions and impulsive reactions. In my experience, at least in terms of improv classes that I taught with you and stuff, you would sort of consider things and digest them and then make a more sort of evolved reaction. And somewhere in there involves like a lot of pausing and thinking and just sort of being inward. And I interpreted that as sort of hostility.
Sure.
Which was not true.
Right. Well, it's easy to.
But I'm bringing it up now because it's one of the things that I like about you.
Yeah.
Like I think it adds to like what a unique voice is. And in a sea of people acting in improv, which tends to attract sort of like impulsive, high energy people.
Uh-huh.
Maybe not. Yeah. I'd say more often than not. It's a relief when you find sort of like the thinkers, you know, the kind of like the introverts, and I think you're one of them. So that's I think you're interesting.
Yeah,
I am introverted, and thank you for the things you said that sounded positive.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I coached you on a practice group that you were on for a while. We can't all live in a cave, or we can't live in a cave. We can't live in a cave.
Yeah.
Which was a great practice group. And there were some heavy hitters on that. It was like you.
We thought of ourselves as a team, but it's good to.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, team.
Yeah.
It was you, Brandon Scott Jones, Dan Chamberlain,
Rory Covey, mm-hmm. Tony Canty.
Yeah, this is the curse of listing members. It's right. always leave one off.
Yeah.
Finelli wasn't on that, right?
No. But you struck me when I was coaching you as a very intense guy who was like super dedicated to being good at improv. Do you feel like you've always been that way with stuff that
with
you've
improv?
Done? Or with stuff that you've done in general? Yeah.
I enjoy things that I'm not good at. I think I don't need to be good at something that I do. I just came from bowling and I'm really bad at it, but I love it. But I definitely pick things and I decide I need to be good at this because I'm not going to have fun unless I am, or I'm not going to be able to do what I want to do unless I get good at it.
So what was it about improv that made you like, I have to be good at this?
It looked so much fun. And I had that thing that a lot of people have when you first see it, which is just confusion and just shock at like, really, they're making all of it up?
Mm-hmm.
Everything they're saying is just, it's coming right into their heads and coming right out of their mouths, all of it. And it was just fascinating in addition to being funny. And I knew that I wanted to do something in entertainment. For a long time, I've had the idea that eventually I'll be a filmmaker, but I never had the intention of like doing comedy mm-hmm. in the meantime or as a career or anything. I just started doing it because it looked super, super fun.
What was your first exposure to improvisation?
I came to school night at UCB.
That was the first time you'd ever seen improv?
Other than Whose Line on TV, mm-hmm. I had never seen any kind of improv at all. I moved to New York in 2006. I didn't know anybody. I stayed in a hostel for the first 2 months because I accepted a job without having an apartment.
Okay.
So a friend that I met at the hostel, who I'm still friends with, I was like, I don't know what to do in the city. I don't know anything about New York City, and I don't have any money. And she said, well, you can always go to UCB. And I was like, well, yeah, but I'd never heard of UCB. I just said that.
Yeah.
And I think like in the room, I immediately on my laptop Googled UCB, found it. It's like, oh, Wednesday nights, there's a free show. And I went and just saw some really funny. I saw, I think maybe Zach Woods and Charlie Sanders do some two-prov.
Mm-hmm.
And Jason Sudeikis and some other people who like are still around or are big names or whatever. And it was just really funny, so I just kept going. Started going to Harold Knight and Ascat.
Huh. Yeah.
Jason Sudeikis? Do you mean Jason Sanes?
No, Sudeikis.
Oh.
Did two-prov with his with his wife at the time.
Kay Kanaka.
Yeah. They did Two Private Sunlight. Right. It was super funny.
They were probably just, I guess, had just, he'd probably just joined the show, SNL, at that time.
That may be.
Yeah.
Maybe.
So you went to UCB, and you loved it, right? Or you were, like, enamored of it, right? And then you decided to start taking classes?
Yep.
What was the motivator for you to take classes? You're just like, I want to get good at this?
I had a feeling like I could be good at it. Mm-hmm. I had a feeling like if I tried really hard, I could get the handle on it and just have a lot of fun doing it. Like you see a video of somebody snowboarding and you're like, that looks amazingly fun. It looks really fun to watch, but I bet it'd be way more fun to actually do it. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it's really hard and there's all kinds of tricks to it and you like fall down a lot. But once you're good at it, it's just probably feels amazing.
Right. Once you get the fundamentals down.
Yeah.
Of it.
I have a snowboard and I'm not very good at it, by the way.
So who was your first teacher?
Zach Woods. Okay. Because he was like one of the first people I saw. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know anybody else. You know,
sure.
Just tried him out. It's great.
And when you first started taking classes, how did it feel?
Super hard and like not at all like what I had been seeing on stage. Completely different. Like it doesn't feel, if you watch a master painter and then you drag a paintbrush across a canvas, it doesn't feel like you're doing the same thing yet.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And it took a long time until it felt like I was actually doing improv.
Mm-hmm.
Super hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard, guys.
Yeah.
Improv? Yeah. I mean, it's always been easy for me, but I understand when people say it's hard. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah. I don't get it. That's a pretty auspicious beginning. Zach's like one of the best improvisers who's ever been here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He coached a practice team that some people put together when I was in like 101 and 201. I was in 101 with Terry Withers and Jen Schwerer. Married couple of improvisers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And looking back, it must have been a hell teaching that class in that practice group, because Zach was just, I mean, he's a genius.
Right.
It's okay to call Zach with a genius, right?
I think so, yeah.
Definitely one of the smartest people I've ever met.
Yeah. And we weren't very easy to work with.
Really?
Why not? How so?
You're all pretty pleasant people.
Well, I mean, I only mentioned three out of the group.
Were you not pleasant to work with because you were just young and not good at it yet? Yeah, or
I just think that it must be. I've never taught or coached a group of people who were literally just starting.
Yeah.
Like just having to teach basic terminology and stuff, I imagine, mm-hmm. is a little exhausting.
Right. Although he might have been in that phase where he's excited just to be doing it. The novelty of like teaching it is, you know.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
He could have been like in a missionary phase where he was excited to like pass on this thing he really liked.
Open people's eyes.
I could imagine that.
What kind of things did you do as you were coming up to make yourself better? Like, what do you think you worked on or focused on?
Well, I was on a lot of teams at the same time, and this is during a period where there was constant discussion on the Improv Resource Center website about everything improv, about how to become a better improviser, how not to. And I remember that there was kind of an ongoing discussion about whether you could do too much improv. And I was always doing the amount of improv that people who thought that there was such a thing as too much improv would have considered too much improv. Like, I was on that end of the spectrum, mm-hmm. just doing, you know, sometimes three practices a week and like a show and everything.
Did you feel like that was helpful to you? Like, what's your take on that? Is there too much improv?
I think that it's completely up to the individual. I don't think that I was doing too much for me. I was doing exactly how much I wanted to do because I wanted to do it.
Right.
I didn't show up, you know, exhausted and thinking, oh no, I'm not enjoying this, but I have to do it to get my reps in or something. Uh-huh. I looked forward to it. So yeah, I think it was the right amount.
So you felt yourself getting better by doing all that kind of stuff. You felt like that was what you needed specifically?
Sometimes. I feel like it's, I don't know how to put this into words, and I think this might be something I've heard you guys say, but it's one of these things where you're going up and down, but on average you're going up.
Sure.
And sometimes you don't realize it, and then suddenly you do it and you realize, oh wait, I'm suddenly realizing that I'm better now than I was mm-hmm. 3 months ago or whatever.
Yeah.
If you were going to coach yourself when you were at like 3014, if you can go back in time and give yourself improv advice, would you?
Would I do that?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I thought you were going to say, what would you say?
I thought that too.
The question is,
would you do it?
Like, would you have anything to say, and what would it be?
Yeah, opportunity.
I would do that.
Okay, what would you say?
I sometimes talk to myself now as if I'm from the future. Have you ever done that?
I have.
I think it's helpful.
Me too.
Like, what do you say?
You're shaking. You're like in the shower the other in the shower the other day. I had a conversation with myself from the perspective of a future me.
Uh huh.
Talking to my present self.
Okay.
And telling me, like, it's gonna be all right. You're gonna find the next thing.
Uh huh.
And it's fine to like worry about what's gonna happen next and. It makes sense. Like you should. It's mm-hmm. it's cool. It's like a good thing, and X, Y, Z, and you know.
Yeah, yeah. I've done stuff like that. I guess I don't think of myself as from the future. I think of myself as like a present day best friend. It's like everything's gonna work out.
But when I talk to myself from the future, I am giving myself innumerable hidden, mysterious gifts that I do not currently know, uh-huh. and I'm looking at myself and saying. You don't know it, but things are going to be amazing. And I'm not going to tell you how they're amazing because I'm not allowed to because of the laws involved in cross...
I see.
Yeah. Cross-dimensional communication. I can't tell you how great it's going to be, but uh-huh. just trust me that it will be.
Okay.
It feels good. But I would say to my younger improviser self, I would just say, just be looser and just like, just try to have a lot of fun and don't worry about whether you're doing the right move or mm. even whether it's funny. Just do it. Because I tend to think that I do a lot of thing about like what improv is, not necessarily what makes good improv, but what it is to begin with. Mm-hmm. And I feel like a lot of it is. So like sometimes we ask ourselves like, why are we doing improv? Are we just doing it because it's fun, or is it a valid art form? Is it just as valid or acceptable as, you know, writing or painting or music or something? Or is it more like just a hobby or a pastime? Mm-hmm. And I think that if it is an art form, the thing that makes it a valid art form or makes it or differentiates it from other things is the fact that you don't know what's going to happen until it happens. Mm-hmm. Not just the that because the audience never knows what's going to happen. When an audience sees a movie, they don't know what's going to happen until it happens.
Right.
But what makes improv different is that the people doing it don't know it until it happens. And I think that the best way to describe that is that they're being fearless, that they're being bold. And I think so many times we laugh at something that happens in a scene, not because it's inherently funny, but because the person did it. Does that make
sense? Yes, it totally makes sense. Like part of it is the laugh of like, I can't believe that just happened. I can't believe somebody just made that move or came up with that.
Which
it's
is
a laugh of surprise.
Yeah, and it's funny sometimes when someone just names someone in the scene. It's really funny because we all know that they just made that up. We all know that it didn't come from anywhere, and it's just funny.
Yeah.
Right. Names almost always get a laugh.
Yeah.
Regardless Specifics of get how a laugh. Funny it might be, how peculiar or fitting or ironic, just giving a specific choice generally gets some kind of reaction.
Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't make it...
Names in particular.
It doesn't make... There's no reason for you to have picked that name.
Right. And if we were in a scene and I just called you Madeline for no reason, somebody in the audience would be like, ah.
And if you said it very confidently,
you're
going against, like, there's an unusual thing in the fact that you knew what to call me. It's unusual based on my understanding that we are in a world where there's no reason for you to give me a name. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it seems like you've done a lot of thinking and analyzing this kind of stuff, thinking about and analyzing this kind of stuff. Are you a generally analytical kind of guy?
I'm afraid so.
Why are you afraid so? Do you feel like it hinders your life in some way?
Of course.
How so? How does analyzing and understanding things?
It's a double-edged sword, John. I was a professional computer programmer for about 5 or 6 years, and you have to be good at that to do that. And in life, sometimes it really helps you, and it can be comforting to kind of understand or think that you understand things. Just assume things, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And then other times, it's crippling and painful and bad.
Sure.
I don't know. I mean, don't you guys feel the same thing? That sometimes it's really hard to know where the line is between overanalysis and just mindfulness?
Yeah, absolutely. It's also kind of hard to, for me personally, it's hard to like
make that transition,
mm-hmm.
like from analytical to creative. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Sometimes like the analytical spills too much into the creative.
Yeah.
You know, it's fine if the creative spills into the analytical, but if,
sure.
You know, if you go into an improv show with too much of the like analytical mind, then it, I found that when I was like teaching, when I was on Harold Night and I was teaching, I would like be in the middle of a Harold being like, I'm fucking analyzing this too much.
When you were teaching, you know? But you were in the middle of your own Harold.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's talk about, early improv with Benjamin Apple.
Okay.
What are some early like breakthrough moments or just like big moments in the narrative of your life as an improviser? Teams or shows or maybe just like
lessons, well, ideally, or moves
what I'd
that
want,
you made.
I'm putting you on the spot. Not everyone has these ready to go. Okay. Sort of like a moment where like, oh yeah, this like really ended up being a moment where I felt like I got it a little bit better.
Okay.
Or I looked back at it as an inspirational moment or something.
One thing that's not a moment, but it was a period, was my indie team Smirk was in a competition at the Magnet, mm-hmm. called the Inferno.
Okay, yeah.
And it was a thing where it was like cage match where if you win, you come back the next week.
Yeah.
And there's a maximum number of wins, which was 9, I think. Like,
yeah.
Once you got to 9, you were kind of retired from the competition.
Mm-hmm.
And we won 9 weeks in a row.
Yes.
And it was a real feeling of accomplishment and of, like, conquering. It's good to win things. It feels really good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It feels great. Like, it's not something we will maybe admit to. We won't think that it's healthy to care about it, but we all do care about it.
Yeah.
Sure.
Smirk is you, Hunter Nelson, Terry Withers, Jen Schwerer. I can't actually
Schwerer,
say
yeah.
Schwerer.
Well,
sorry.
She's now, I think Withers. She changed her name because they got married.
Yeah.
But, and at the time it was also Tom DeMena, who doesn't really do improv anymore.
Right.
There's another moment I had was in one of your classes, Will, in The End of the World.
Oh, yeah.
600 level class.
Yeah. The apocalypse class.
Do you remember the scene where...
can I guess what it's going to be?
Yeah.
Is it the one where you were stealing the chip witch from the person?
Yeah. There's a scene... It was a post-apocalyptic world, and there's, I think, one chip witch left on Earth. And someone was going to pick it up, and I came in the scene as an old man and said, like... Now wait a minute now.
You're right.
Don't be hasty.
Right, right, right.
Just be calm.
And it sounded like you were gonna say something, but all you were doing was inching closer to it.
Yeah. And saying
your only delaying tactic
like everybody
was, hold on now, everyone stay calm. Everything's fine as yeah. you were like slowly creeping towards stealing yeah. it. Yeah, it was like insanely funny. Wasn't like just everybody giggling for the entire time?
I think so. But it was a moment where I was just acting on instinct. I would never have come into the scene intending to do that.
Yeah.
But I thought, this is what this character is doing. And I'm going to keep doing it even if it doesn't seem like I would have told someone to do that. Or
yeah.
I wouldn't have like blessed that move in a scene. I wouldn't have said that would be a good idea to do.
Yeah.
And it was, I think, a moment of realizing that what's funny about improv is just making a decision. You just make a decision. And in the moment, if you make a decision, it will be weird. It'll always be weird.
Yeah.
You can't make good decisions in an imaginary world on stage, being watched by a dozen to 150 strangers.
Yeah.
Right.
It won't be normal. If you just make a decision and stick with it and don't allow anybody to change your mind, it's going to be funny. Funny. Most of the time.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's one of the like most important things about this is just learning how to make choices and be okay with making choices.
Mm-hmm. Another moment was also in The End of the World. I had a realization that it's like okay to fuck with people and it's okay to do something that's funny because it's kind of shitting on something else
yeah.
in a way, which was someone had a scene where their son died
uh-huh.
and it was very tragic and it was...
yeah.
We were like on a gas station on a cloud in the sky, I think. Like it was
oh, yeah.
a world where everybody was always on jetpacks and like we were
right.
all like
the whole world had moved up into the sky.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And somebody's son died and it was tragic and it was terrible and they were really committing to the scene. And I very jauntily, after that ended, I kind of jauntily landed on the ground and said,
Do you have those Slim Jims that are like flat, like a belt? Like, yeah. like a strip of jerky?
Oh, yeah. I remember this. Might have been Kirk D'Amato. Might have been the guy. I remember that sequence.
But I remember thinking, like, it's okay to kind of... to make a joke about someone else's improv.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah, yeah. Sort of. I mean, that's pretty... You were having fun with... They were so committed.
Yeah.
And you were exploiting that for a funny moment.
Yeah. And I think that previous to that, I would have felt bad about it. Right. Even in the moment, I was like, this might be bad for me to do, but I think it'll be really funny. Like trusting the instinct that it's going to be good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, it was a good class. A lot of good people.
Yeah, I saw at least one of those shows, and they were great. And I actually remember you being particularly strong in that class. I remember you
Dern
standing
was in that class, Nate Dern.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The man who just came in here and put you on the regulars.
Yeah. It was a fun group.
Let's say that an improv team is a band. What instrument are you playing? Are you the bassist of an improv group? Are you the guitarist? Are you the drummer?
An improv team is band.
Like the government comes in and says, like,
let's say,
you are forbidden.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Let's say a drone flies in here and eliminates a heresy. So what do you consider yourself like?
What does a band have? A band has a drummer.
Drummer,
a
bassist,
rhythm,
yeah, guitarist.
Rhythm, bassist, lead guitar, and vocalist.
You have no bass, idea. Drum, rhythm guitar, lead guitar.
Yeah, like are you the guy?
Keys.
Yeah.
Extra percussion.
Right, like a
singer,
bassist might
singer,
be just like tambourine. Kind of just like driving the rhythm, kind of like keeping the rhythm going.
Yeah.
You know, guitarist might be like making big wild kind of solos or big riffs. Like,
could I be harmonica?
Yeah. Sure. What does that mean to you?
I spent a lot of shows not being in it very much,
mm-hmm.
and then coming in a way where I want to really commit hard to one specific thing, just mm-hmm. one thing. Like, you know how sometimes in a Dylan song when he plays harmonica, it's actually annoying how loud he's playing it.
Right.
It's like, Bob, you don't have to play it that loud. Mm-hmm. We hear you playing the harmonica. I think a little like that.
Uh-huh.
Like, I'll just come in and sometimes I'll be afraid that maybe this isn't funny, so I'll just do it louder and harder.
So that's something that you actively try to do, is like kind of stay off and then come in?
No, I'm just terrified.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You're still terrified as
Absolutely.
An improviser?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, I don't mean that to sound like, why are you still terrified?
No, I mean, I'm not always terrified, but in general, I feel nervous until I know why I'm doing something, and mm-hmm. then I feel really good and I really enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. Does that nervousness excite you?
Mm-hmm.
That,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I try to use it. I have a little focusing device where I picture all of my fear and nervousness as a stone in my hand, where I'm holding it,
mm-hmm.
and I can feel the weight of it, but it's also manageable because I'm choosing to hold it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll do that backstage and just picture the weight of a rock in my hand.
I do visualizations like that. Mm-hmm. Do you do other ones? If you do one, you probably do more than one, right?
What else do I do? Nothing else comes to mind right now, but I probably have a couple.
So I give you open invitation throughout this podcast to bring up any visualizations.
To remember ones?
If your brain just comes across any ones that you have,
okay.
No matter what we're talking about, tell me what it is.
Thank
where,
you.
Where'd you get that from? Where'd you get that? Where does that come from in you,
know.
You think?
I don't know if Are I heard that somewhere or if I just came up with it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I've been doing it for a few years, so I can't remember where I got it.
You a spiritual guy at all, or you think that just comes from like analytic kind of mind?
My dad is a preacher, and I was raised very religiously,
mm-hmm.
and then left all of it in one go right after college. And I do not feel spiritual or religious.
You say very religious, like what kind of very religious are we talking about? Like,
it's a small fundamentalist Christian denomination called the Church of Christ,
mm-hmm.
with no drinking, no dancing, no, anything that a church would be against, they're against it.
Okay.
Basically. Wow. You know.
Sounds pretty severe.
My parents are warm and sweet people, but their beliefs I consider severe.
Yeah.
Sure.
So you know that serious air of yours I was talking about before?
Uh-huh.
Did your parents have that?
I don't think so. My dad does sometimes. My mom, not so much.
Mm-hmm.
My mom's really silly and goofy.
How did they take it when you were kind of like, this isn't my bag?
Oh, they're pretty upset.
Yeah.
Yeah. If something doesn't change, I'm going to hell.
Right.
Hmm. So you have a brother. In their eyes.
How many brothers? Do you have, you have at least one brother?
No, just I am. I have an older brother who lives in the city and a younger sister who lives in Tennessee with my parents. She's going to school.
Is your older brother with you in this type of thinking?
He is religious. He's not. He has, you might say, mellowed a little bit in relative to our parents, but he's very active and you know religious. Mm-hmm.
Did you have something?
I can come back to it.
Yeah. Go ahead if you've got it.
It's off topic.
Okay.
I want to go back to improv for a second.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you're backstage. Mm-hmm. I'm curious what you're. Let's go a couple months in the future. You've been on the regulars a couple months, so the novelty of the first couple shows and being back is over.
So are you talking to Benjamin from the future right now? Yeah, the one that talks to him in the
I'm
shower.
I'm really asking the Benjamin of the present to communicate with Benjamin of the future and ask him.
Link established.
Yeah. Okay. really, it's just sort of like I want like a routine.
Okay.
Herald night, but a Herald night as opposed to an indie show, like something where it's like a little bit of high pressure. Pressure is the wrong word, but you want this to go well. You're bringing your best self to this show,
uh-huh.
as opposed to deliberately screwing off, which sometimes someone might use an indie show for or something.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, okay,
screwing off.
Yeah, sometimes like you have an indie show where you're like, I got to blow off steam, man. I got to just like,
and you just don't even think, and you just kind of fuck it up on purpose.
Just say whatever's in my head so that I can get loose.
Yeah.
Approach it with the same rigor and discipline that you might Harold Knight.
You're bringing game face to this show, okay. Whatever that means to you. And so you're backstage. Do you have that stone visualization?
Mm-hmm.
What else do you do to like? You're back there. How do you envision the show starting? What's your mindset like there?
Well, it's funny that you describe indie shows that way and Herald Night that way because, in a way, it's almost the opposite for me. Mm-hmm. When I go into a show that has stakes just by virtue of the fact that it's on the UCB stage and there are a lot of people watching, I am not thinking, all right, time to take this seriously and mm-hmm. like. My game face is not a game face. It's mm-hmm. like, don't think about it. Don't worry about it. Just be ready to have fun. It's the, does that make sense?
It does.
Like to do my best, I have to be not, I'm not stealing myself to do my best. I'm just trying to do the opposite and like get loose.
Sure.
Because of those introverted instincts and that fear and stuff.
Can we go this minute? Can we go into this much minutia? Like how do you interact with the other people backstage? Do you like saying got your back or do you not say that?
I don't.
Do you like to not make eye contact, or is it very important that you make eye contact?
I love making eye contact right backstage. I love looking up and down that narrow hallway and looking at people and kind of catching someone's eye and sharing a little smile.
Uh-huh.
I don't like saying got your back, but when someone says it to me, I will say it back to that one person.
Uh-huh. You're not going to leave them hanging on that.
Yeah.
Right. What don't you like about it?
Because I'm starting out from the assumption that we all have each other's backs. And when someone says it, it's like if I'm getting in a car with you and you say, we're not going to die. It's like, you're bringing my attention to that fact. Like, if I got in a car with you and you said, I will not drive headlong into oncoming traffic. I won't cross the median at all. I'm concerned now. And it just feels a little, I don't want to be, I don't want to be negative, but it just seems a little hokey. It just seems a little like, we're a team. We're, you know, we're kind of a family in this, mm-hmm. and to need to say it out loud, I just don't feel it.
Sure.
What's your preferred initiation style? No like opening, just a suggestion. First scene of
no
set.
Opening?
No opening.
Wait, what do you mean?
What size initiation do you like? Do you like a big full premise? Do you like something real small? Do you like nonverbal? Do you like something mysterious and weird that has to be figured out?
You almost always start off with one small token piece of object work.
Uh-huh.
I will almost always walk into a scene and open a can of something.
Yeah.
Or
some equivalent.
Cut something up or close the refrigerator or something.
Mm-hmm.
As I'm saying, hey, Jerry, I wanted to ask you something and kind of give the other person a name mm-hmm. and in my tone try to imply whether we're family, friend, or coworker.
Let's just try it right now. Mm-hmm. Let's say you and John are doing a two-prop set. Mm-hmm. School night.
Okay.
You get 15 minutes. I'm just going to give you a suggestion. I want to hear what your initiation is.
Okay. with 15 minutes of school night? That's a lot of time.
Yeah, this is a special night. It's great.
Yeah, a couple of people canceled.
This is school night 2002. There was no school night, but whatever. Okay, so your suggestion is Mars.
Hey, Jerry.
You're opening a can.
Jerry, you know that men and women are not literally from different planets.
I gotcha. Mm-hmm.
You know that. So I'm doing a little gifting, but it's not completely clear.
Right.
You haven't nailed everything down.
I'm right. giving the other person an opportunity to make a big decision.
Right. And sort of implying.
Because nothing occurred to me. I didn't have a big decision from that, so I thought, I'll give you 50% and mm-hmm. like see what you come back with.
It's also good because it's an implication that we were having a conversation. You're starting the scene in the middle. You know, it's like you're
I like doing that.
You're
I
gifting like doing my character in that scene with the idea that I believe that men and women are really from Mars, and that I maybe it seems yeah. to me if I heard that initiation, I would think, oh, I was just arguing very rigorously for the idea. That,
yeah.
You know, or I just made some strong statement that implied that I believed that.
Right.
So.
And then if your response was, well, then why do people say it? Then now you've got the choice of, the whole conversation is not going to be about Mars versus Venus. It's like when this person hears something, they believe it.
Right.
So, but I don't know. I like giving someone something to start off with.
Mm-hmm. I don't know why I want to ask this.
Okay.
What's your opinion on talking animals in scenes?
When an animal talks? One?
No, when people are playing like animals. Like somebody flaps their wings like a bird and be like, woof, look at this tree. You know?
Wait, when the entire scene takes place between just animals?
Well, or yeah, when, yeah, yeah. Or at least it starts that way. If I walk out as an animal and I'm talking and I talk to you and I'm kind of implying that you're one of me.
Right.
I don't like that, but I would be fine with watching that scene. If I was in that scene, I would feel really weird and I wouldn't know what to do, and I would...
Don't you find it somewhat common, though, the talking animal genre of improv scene?
I don't remember seeing much of it.
You don't think that?
But what I thought you were going to say, and what I see more of and what bothers me, is a human playing an animal in a scene that's taking place between other humans. So,
right.
You know, we're a couple of people and someone says... the dog keeps sitting on my whatever, and then Will comes out as the dog,
right.
I wish that we had found a way to make a scene that did not have an animal in it,
right?
Because it's so weird and distracting to me to have a human play an animal.
But it's also like that scene could still take place without somebody coming in as the animal.
Yeah,
you know. Like, the animal's not necessarily the focus of the scene.
That's interesting.
It's also, I get annoyed when people, like, I don't like people like in that situation or a similar situation, if somebody walks in as the dog and talks like a human,
yeah.
Then I
tend to think that when there's this idea that a scene shouldn't be about something that's not actually in the scene, mm-hmm. and sometimes people interpret that by saying, if we're talking about something that's not in the scene, then now we're talking about something that's not actually happening, and in order to remedy that, we need to bring that into the scene. We need mm-hmm. to add something.
Sure.
But what I prefer, and the way I love to see it played, is if I'm talking to you about how, like, your dog keeps sitting on my bed, mm-hmm. then it can't be about the dog.
Right.
Because I'm a genius, and I've said, dude, your dog keeps getting on my bed like it's his.
Right.
So it cannot be about the dog. It's taken for granted that it's not about the dog, so it must be about you and me, and what's already happening is what the scene is about.
Mm-hmm.
So I would prefer to have a scene where you are like arguing for animal rights, like,
right.
like why shouldn't they have the comfort and convenience of a raised and padded place to sit down, as opposed to let's see that dog in and
totally.
Sit on some more stuff,
because then it just becomes about the dog, which was just a distraction, yeah. and it's not about the dog.
Yeah.
What's your? I kind of want to ask this based on that last question, but what's your feeling on gibberish in scenes? Like, if you have to talk in gibberish, or like, are you comfortable with that?
You mean like two aliens from a planet, so they're just talking,
or even
gibberish?
Like having to talk in a different language that you don't know, and so you sort of have to, you know, when you talk in like when you like fake a foreign language.
Yeah, I like doing that.
Okay,
I just think it's fun, and that you can. It's a fun exercise. I don't mean to do it as an exercise, but like in a scene, right. It's fun to see if you can successfully make a scene work without people just getting laughs by virtue of the fact that you sound funny.
Sure.
Right.
Can we talk about writing for a little bit?
Yeah,
is that okay?
Let's
do it. So you're a writer, obviously. Mm-hmm. What's your process like? Like, say you're writing a sketch. Mm-hmm. What's your creative process like?
I always keep track of, like, any idea I try to write down on my phone as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I have a reason to write, either because I have a personal project or I have a deadline, I just go through my notes and just pick, you know, I just pick something that strikes me in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes it'll just be a phrase or something I saw or an idea, like what if someone did X, Y, Z? And then I'll just kind of work backwards from there and try to figure out when and where would be the funniest time and place for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And just write it so that it happens a lot.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What are when you're writing a sketch, like for when you were on Onassis and you're writing a sketch, what are you trying to, do you have like things that you like to do in your sketch?
Yes.
Things that you like to be true about your sketches?
Well, I didn't, it wasn't intentional, but eventually I came to write a lot of what my teammates call left turn sketches, where like the first two or three pages are one thing and then the rest of the sketch is another thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I got the impression that some people, either teammates or just other people in the community or theoretical human beings, might consider that to be a gimmick.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, sure, if you can just make the sketch suddenly change into another sketch. But I don't consider it a gimmick. I think that that's how life is, that you don't... Like, the idea of a sketch itself is weird. You're setting up these expectations. So in life, we're always going through it one moment at a time, and something has to really catch your attention for you to notice it because you're not waiting for it. But instead, we're all sitting down facing the same rectangle of empty space, and then some humans walk out onto it, and lights turn on them. And we're saying, watch this. Like, the lights were off, and now they're on, and now something is happening. So it's already incredibly bizarre. It's not normal.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It doesn't make any sense. So if part of the expectation is that in the next 3 to 5 minutes, one type of funny thing will happen, that starts to really grate on me. And I don't like that has to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would rather, in the moment, do what I think would be funny, write what I think would be the funniest thing to happen in this moment. And if the funniest thing to happen is for this one thing to keep happening, then sure, do that. But sometimes I just think it needs to be something different now.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote a lot of those sketches. And I've heard Tim and Eric say that they get tired of their sketches. They get tired of them very quickly. So a lot of the times they'll write a sketch and then they're like, this feels too long. I don't want this to be 3 minutes. So after 2 minutes, let's suddenly switch to something else, or let's fuck with the editing to make it a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just following your instincts.
Sure. Yeah, and Onassis was a very successful mod team at the theater. How mm-hmm. do you think, what contributed to that? Like, what do you think was behind your success?
I think everybody on the team wanted to work really hard and not just take the path of least resistance. Like, everybody was really just working hard, like doing a lot of rewrites and like really putting their egos aside and accepting notes, like hard notes. And it was very, like, there's a lot of trust and just comfort and knowing that this will not get on stage unless it's really funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I want my sketch to get in the show, and therefore I'm going to accept every single note from all of these people that I think are really funny.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a very collaborative process. Like, we really, you know, just put all the sketches through their paces, and we wouldn't put something up unless we all thought it was really funny. And we were really lucky to have Seth Reese, the head writer of The Onion, be our director for 6 months in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And he had that attitude as well of like, we're going to make the funniest show possible. And if that means that one person has 3 sketches in and 2 people don't have any sketches in, that's fine. Or if that means that one of the sketches is going to be 7 minutes long, because that's the funniest possible version of that sketch, then that's mm-hmm. what we're going to do.
you guys had, you were known for having outside the community directors, right? Mm-hmm. Like you had a lot of non-UCB community directors.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, we made a point of it, I think, for two reasons. One is we wanted to get people with professional writing experience no matter where they came from.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, a lot of time that meant going outside of UCB, not because UCB people don't have experience, but because in general, it's hard to find someone who does have professional experience, but is also available to direct stuff because they're very busy. So when we found someone and they were from outside of UCB or they had done some UCB stuff, but not very much, we were like, well, let's get that person because we want to learn how it works in the business. And that wasn't because we all wanted to get into the business as quickly as possible. It was because we thought that they would have a very high standard.
Sure.
They wouldn't be, you know, have kid gloves with us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think another thing was we all loved UCB and came up through UCB classes and shows and stuff. And we all felt like if we want to bring something new to UCB, why would we keep working with only UCB people?
Mm-hmm.
Not because there's not a wide variety. There's a huge variety.
Yeah.
But why not just constantly inject new life into the process? And sometimes it did not work. Sometimes we went outside of UCB and somebody had a very different mindset and we like really struggled through it.
Mm-hmm.
And other times it was exactly what we needed.
Yeah, that was one of the things I was going to ask you is, do you feel like doing that, like was it easy or difficult to stay within the sort of mindset or of the like UCB approach to sketch, or was that something that you were conscious of or cared about at all? You know, because a lot of times, like with Maud Knight, it's very much like, you know, you write game.
Yeah.
You know, you present a game and you play the game on sketch, like,
yeah,
or through a sketch. Like, were you conscious of trying to stick with that, or was it something that occurred to you at all?
It was something we thought about and something we talked about. And, two things. One is, we always had at one point there was an email, depending on when it happened, it might've been from Nate. I don't think it was from Anthony. I'm trying to remember. We had maybe we had a show that we got some harsh notes on or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And someone said in an email to us, I want you to think of Maud Knight as the final stage of your UCB sketch writing education. And we heard that and we thought about it. And I think that we couldn't help but disagree with
right.
it mm-hmm. because it went against our instincts.
Mm-hmm.
Our instincts were to not treat Maud Knight as the final step in our education, but in the first step in whatever you want to call what comes after an education.
Sure.
Which is you're no longer, you always try to learn and evolve and develop, but there's a point at which you're thinking, I want to start breaking rules instead mm-hmm. of memorizing them. I want to start doing things in ways that I maybe have been told not to do them, or I have just not been told to do them.
Mm-hmm.
And we felt ready to do that, and we wanted to do it really bad. And so we just did it. And for us in that place and time, I think that was the right decision.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not it's right for everybody is, you know, another thing.
Sure.
But another thing is, you know, at one point we got some notes about game or something, and Seth Reese was directing us at the time, and he said, guys, game is just clear writing. That's what it is. Like, if you're writing something and it's clear what's happening, that is game. So whether you use the word game or you just want to make it funny, like if it's funny, there's game.
Right.
I believe that. I believe that game is a kind of a codified approach to describing something that exists outside of that codified approach.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So like if something's funny, then there is game to it.
That's right.
Whether or not you're aware of it or not.
Yeah. If there's a clear idea, then there's game.
Yeah. So we tried to
I've heard Ian Roberts say that.
Yeah.
Game just, if something's funny, there's a game.
So we just tried to make it really funny, like make each other laugh and make ourselves laugh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, some people might say that, like, it could be easy to, like, look at you guys' shows towards the end and think, like, well, these guys aren't doing, like, what what you expect to see when you come to Mod Night. I'm not saying that I'm saying that. I'm saying that that's, you know, it could be perceived as that.
I agree. And yeah. I think that we probably had I think that the team had a good batting average, but also a lot of strikeouts. And I think that's what we wanted. We wanted to, like, we would regularly put up sketches and say, this might go very, very badly. Mm-hmm. And we didn't take pride in something going very badly. Like, I don't think we ever had a sketch fail and we're like, these idiots, they didn't see how funny it was.
Right.
I can't believe they didn't see how funny it was.
Yeah.
We never had that thought. We just always thought, well, we tried it. It didn't work, but I'm so glad that we tried it.
And you guys also had a bunch of, like you said, a bunch of really great, strong, hilarious sketches. And you guys were trying to do stuff outside of the theater, or not trying, you were doing things outside of the, you won the Friars Club comedy fest competition or whatever it was, and you shot a pilot.
Yeah,
off
we
of
shot
that.
It's supposed to be a short film, and we decided, well, let's make it 30 minutes long and call it a pilot, you know. And it was really fun. It was super intense, and but you know, we got it done. And
yeah. You had relationships with College Humor guys. You were making videos with them, right?
Yeah, we established that a while ago, and then it took a long time for anything to actually happen. They wanted to shoot one of our sketches, so they shot it, and then they actually never released it because for some reason or another, it just never got released. But we kept talking to them about doing a web series, and then eventually, after I left the team, they did one or two sketch videos with them. And we also just – we got a couple of College Humor people on Onassis, so the team just had a good relationship with them.
Sure.
They're cool people.
I got a question about collaboration.
Okay.
So Onassis sounds like it was a pretty teamy team, but you also rejected notes you didn't agree with. So how did that happen internally? Like, I guess I'm going to be like quibbling a little bit, or I don't know. This might be...
Do it.
I'm curious about this, because I feel like when it's working, like when chemistry works and everyone's on the same page, then it just feels like everybody is saying yes to everything, and people will come out of those environments and say, got to just say yes. You got to just go with it. But then, like, in teams where it's not working, I think I've been in both of these. You can't say yes to everything because you don't agree with anything that's being said. It's hard to get to this momentum where you can just, like,
yeah.
I don't know. How would you, in a good environment, in a good collaborative environment, like it sounds like Onassis was, I don't know. Can you just break down how could somebody disagree or work together? Certainly, or was it just that everything out of everybody's mouths was always the right thing?
No, and we did disagree.
Yeah.
We disagreed a lot, but I think that there was an underlying agreement that disagreeing was fine. There was at a very deep level, everybody was agreeing all the time, always. So if that's already happening and you tell me this sketch is not funny, you're not disagreeing with me at the level that actually matters. You are saying, you and I agree that I'm going to tell you whatever I think, always. And right now, it's that I don't think that this sketch is funny. Just because your fingers typed it and it came out of your brain doesn't mean I'm talking about you. I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about this sketch right here. Right. And if we all understand that, then we'll be disappointed, but never upset with each other and never hurt on a personal level.
Can you give me an example of you or someone not getting their way and having to just back off?
I mean, it happened constantly. Can think of an example of it.
I think that's an important thing as...
Well, you know, because I'm sorry, John, I'm just going to...
Go ahead.
What I meant was like, you said you did a pilot together.
Mm-hmm.
So like, six writers?
Yeah.
How did that work in writing a pilot?
Well, the pilot's actually not a great example of our working process because we had to shoot it in such a short period of time that we kind of took a bunch of sketches and just kind of put them together and tried to find a narrative to thread them together. That's not how we usually work.
Okay. And in a show, it's easier because you can parse it out. Like someone's doing this, someone's doing this. So,
but there were definitely times when I felt very strongly that not only was it important for something to happen in a sketch, but if it didn't happen, then the sketch was worthless and I don't even want to do it. Like my sketch.
Yeah.
If in my sketch, this person doesn't get slapped in the face or if it doesn't end like this, then there's no point to the sketch to me anymore. If this one moment doesn't happen.
But you'd throw it out and be all right with that then.
I what?
In this case, you'd be like, well, let's just throw it out. We'll just do something else. Rather than give up the moment in this hypothetical example.
Well, I mean, the director always has final say.
Right.
And that's how we worked, and I think that's how a team should work. I think the goal of a director should be a dictator. I really think that a director should be a benevolent dictator and say no to everything that they don't like and say yes to everything that they like and focus the team's sense of humor through their sense of humor. And that if the team thinks it's funny but the director doesn't think it's funny, then the director is actually doing them a disservice by putting it in the show. So if you can't convince the director that it's funny, then I think you have to be okay with it not going in the show. That's how I feel about it. I think there are a lot of people who probably think that the opposite is true and that the director should put in the show what the team wants to go in the show.
Yeah.
I think it's just two different ways to approach it.
Like being in service of the team's vision rather than filtering through his or her own vision. I don't know. Depends. I've directed teams and been won over. You know, read a sketch and been like, no. Mm-hmm. But then they'll all talk about it and they'll be filled with such enthusiasm. I'll be like, well, I don't know. You guys talking about it makes me laugh.
Yeah.
Now I want to see it. And I think that is sort of like you're being subservient then to like a group mind.
But I've been in a room where people are laughing at something and maybe I'm just a miser or something, but I'm thinking these people are funny and I like them, but what they're laughing at right now is not funny and they will not think it's funny later. If we go ahead and do this thing that we're laughing at right now, guarantee you that it will not be funny. It's funny because it's 11 o'clock at night right now and we're tired, or because it's based on the context of this writer's room.
Yeah.
Like that's why we're laughing at it, but that's not going to be funny on stage. Mm-hmm. But sometimes that instinct is wrong, and sometimes you think something's going to be hilarious and you put it on stage and nobody laughs, nobody sure. likes it.
Yeah.
One more question on this. Let's say you're directing a team and they have bad chemistry. Mm-hmm. Morale is bad. Team doesn't like each other. Maybe it's people they do, but they're having a lot of trouble getting it together.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do?
Try to focus on what I like and try to have an infectious energy. Try to be really excited and convince them of how funny things are.
Mm-hmm.
And show them that there's one person in the room who is confident that the show is going to be really funny and that believes in the team. And that they can just say, well, Benjamin's going to make sure that my sketch is funny. And he's also going to defend my sketch from anybody who might not think it's funny. And also I think sometimes the director's job is to shut people down and say, hold that thought for a second and just keep talking and just ignore just jump over the roadblocks and just don't let people be negative. Just keep it moving in a positive direction.
Because
people's feelings can get really hurt very, very quickly. In 5 words, you can really crush somebody.
Sure. Yeah. So the skills that you learned or that... I'm trying to distill everything I want to ask down to one question. How, if at all, did you feel like what you were doing on Maud Night served you in a writer's room at Fallon?
I felt very prepared when I went in there. And I actually sent Anthony King an email like 6 or 8 months ago or so and said, thank you for putting me on a Maud team, because I'm here at Fallon and I'm feeling like I came in here with all the basic tools and equipment that I needed to do that job. And it clearly came directly from being on a Maud team. When you have an idea that you think is really funny, if there's a question mark at the end of every sentence, if you're saying, I don't know, this is kind of a half idea, I don't know about this, then nobody will think it's funny. Like confidence counts even just amongst your peers. It clearly counts on stage, but it also counts when I'm just telling you, hey, I have an idea. And it taught me to be confident in my ideas and to know what I'm going to pitch before I pitch it and articulate it clearly, and also not worry if people say no to it. I think those were really important. And I had sketches go up on Maud Night that I had written 12 or 13 drafts of, that I was used to constantly rewriting and trying to get it in shape. So I think being on Maud Night teaches you like a work ethic, try to not have an ego, and to be confident in your ideas, and those were all really important.
Did you find that your instinct for making left turns and sketches served you in a professional capacity or in that environment?
No, not at all. But because So when I got let go, 80 Miles, the head writer of the show, who I like a lot, he's super, super funny guy.
Yeah.
Just very honest and said, there's not enough overlap between your voice and the show's voice. And I was like, I agree with you. I had a low batting average there.
Okay.
And it was just because this show wanted to do this thing and I wanted to do this thing. And sometimes I was able to find a common ground. And that's what I was trying really hard to do.
Right.
Like, you're pitching to the voice of the show while trying not to lose your own personality. You're trying to kind of pitch a mix of things that I think is funny, but maybe the show wouldn't do. Mm-hmm. And then also pitch something that you think the show would do, even if it's not at the top of your list of like mm-hmm. favorite things to do. And, sometimes it just doesn't, it doesn't work out.
Yeah. Was there a point where you, like you said, you had a low batting average on the show. Was there a point where you started to feel that and started to feel kind of nervous?
Totally. Yeah.
How did you?
It was really early on.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So how do you deal with that? Like, how do you keep your shit together when that feeling starts to creep in?
Well, I don't know if I did keep my shit together.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not sure what to tell you. But I can tell you is... I tried to remember that I was a funny person, mm-hmm. and that the people that I look up to and that I think are really funny and that are like my comedy colleagues, have convinced me through the way I've been accepted in the community, or that like just the success of an individual sketch or whatever, I think that someone can't stop being funny, basically.
Right.
Like this is something I've heard people talk on the podcast about before, which is if someone sees you fail at something, they will not stop thinking you're funny. You literally cannot stop being funny. So if you see someone not be funny, and this is the first time you've ever seen them, and you see them not be funny 8 times, you'll think that they're not funny. But then the first time you see them be really funny, the switch can go on but not off. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, now I know that they're funny. I didn't know it, but now I know it and I'll never stop thinking it. Mm-hmm. So I tried to do that with myself, mm-hmm. and say, Benjamin, you're a really funny guy. You know that. And just really jerk myself off. Yeah. And try, because it really beats down on your ego and your confidence to be in a room full of people and be pitching your ideas, and like most of your ideas don't happen.
Sure.
It's difficult. It wears you down.
Yeah.
So you have to find a way to keep coming up with ideas that you're excited about, even if you don't think that they're going to happen. Because you have to pitch stuff that you're excited about, no matter what the context is. Sure. So I just tried really hard to do that. And also, hang out with in a crowd of people where I did feel funny. You know, UCB people in the theater and friends and stuff like that. Mm-hmm.
You'd come to Mod Night a lot during that, I remember.
I tried to, yeah.
After you're on film, and I still saw you at maybe every Onassis show.
And yeah, anyone that I could make it to.
Yeah. I was at that, I don't know, as someone who's been around a long time, I find it heartening when someone else seems to find strength in the community. I felt like that's what was going on.
I don't think that any place in the world is making funnier stuff than UCB. It clearly gets bigger than UCB, but it doesn't get better than UCB. Like, if what you want is to laugh really hard at something or to do something to make people laugh really hard, UCB is the place to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think that anytime you leave a live audience, anytime you leave a small audience, if you do a great job at it, it can stay that good.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not going to get better, and most of the time it gets worse. So whatever you're doing, I don't think there's any reason to ever not go to UCB. And I'm not saying that because I'm UCB. I'm saying it's just...
That's how you feel.
That's right. Where you go.
You're not saying it as a company man, because you're not a company man. Right? Like, you're not speaking as a representative of...
No, I mean, I don't think so. I don't know. I don't know how to maneuver that.
You mean like
question.
Somebody who works here?
You weren't
here?
Saying it out of obligation. Like, right. Oh, I feel like I should.
You're saying out of genuine
a lot. You were just saying it.
No, I mean, when I was at Fallon, as lucky as I felt, as fortunate and like the as big an opportunity as it was, I missed UCB constantly. And at a continuous level,
right.
I missed performing on the UCB stage and being constantly surrounded by UCB people and at McManus. And partly because those people are my best friends, but also partly because it's just like so fulfilling and like Vitalizing? Is, yeah. Did you say vitalizing instead of revitalizing?
Invigorating?
I don't know.
Well, I'll accept it.
Yeah, it's the best.
Mm-hmm. So what's happening for you now? What's next for you, or what are you currently working on, other than just being put on the regulars?
I'm working on that, and still doing Sketch Cram every month.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right. We didn't talk at all about Sketch Cram. It's, you were part of Whale Thief, which is you, Zach, and Brandon, right?
Me, Zach Poitras, Brandon Gullia, Matt Kleinman, and Matt Mayer.
That's right. Matt Kleinman and Matt Mayer.
Yeah.
Just forgetting about
that. I've never heard. What did you say? Whale Thief?
That's what you guys call your... Yeah, explain what Whale Thief is.
Well, so like a little over 2 years ago, Matt Kleinman went to Nate Dern and said, can we start doing Sketch Cram at the theater again? Because it used to be done, and then it wasn't for a while.
Right. It was created by Gethard and Charlie Sanders.
Yeah. And then it was done in L.A., and Kleinman picked it up while he was in L.A. for like less than a year at some point. And he came back and said, can we start doing it here again? And asked me and these other guys to do it with him. And then after doing it for like a year and a half, we said, we've been working together all this time on just Sketchcram. Let's do something else. Let's make a video special, like kind of like we described it like an album, but of sketches. Mm-hmm. And we decided we should have a name if we were going to do that. So we decided on Whale Thief. Mm-hmm. So now we're Whale Thief, but people usually just know us as the Sketchcram guys.
Right.
But yeah, late this summer, we shot like a 20 to 30 minute comedy special that we're editing right now that we're going to release at some point. In addition to doing Sketch Cram every month that it used to be.
A comedy special with sketches and stand-up and stuff like that? Or
Just sketches. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could call it a pilot. I think we're just not calling it a pilot because we don't care if it gets on TV. We're just doing it for fun.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. And you guys did a feature-length movie, Cram, last month, that was, right?
I want to say 2 months ago. I don't remember
the date. Maybe it was 2 months ago, yeah.
But, it was over 100 people.
Mm-hmm.
Like 12 writers or something like that, and 20 directors and 70 actors, something like that, in 24 hours.
So, like, I'm like a new writer. Maybe I'm like a 101 student, or I'm just like kind of getting into it. And I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know, like, I don't know how to make things funny. I don't know how to put a sketch. I'm drowning here. What's your advice to me?
If someone really doesn't understand, I would ask them for like what are some of their favorite funny things, and then just ask them, what do you think is funny about that? And if they can explain anything about why it's funny, then they kind of know what they're doing already. Mm-hmm. And just if you can think of anything that's funny, try to think about why it's funny and just do more of it. And don't even show it to anybody at first. Just like do a bunch of it.
Mm-hmm.
And just get all the crap out of your system. Like get used to writing without being afraid of whether it's going to be good or not.
Mm-hmm.
And just see a lot of it, talk to people about it. I would, after all those shows for like the first 2 years that I was doing improv and watching improv, I would go out with people for drinks after seeing a show or doing a show and just talk constantly. Talk about like what worked, what didn't work. Why was that good? Why was that someone else's show? Why were they so good? What makes that one person on that one team so good?
Mm-hmm.
Just talking about it. Like, you know, you can't help it.
I think that's really valuable to be able to like have a conversation after anything you see, like a sketch show, an improv show, a play, a movie, to go out and have that conversation. Like,
yeah.
I liked this. Why did I like this? I didn't get this, you know,
yeah.
Just sort
it's
of
almost the best part in a way. It's
yeah.
just so much fun.
Yeah.
To talk about it. So Sketch Cram, and, I'm in the process of writing a web series that I want to shoot.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in the early stages of writing an original pilot, and just, you know, stuff like that might turn into something or might not.
This is one thing I wanted to touch on. I know we're getting towards the end here, but if I recall correctly, like you tried a couple of times to get on Harold Knight, right? Like
I think I auditioned 5 times.
Yeah,
either 5 or 6 times before I got put on. Yeah.
So what was that process like for you, or what like? What kept you going? What was the most frustrating about that? Like talk.
And if you can, speak a little bit. When you got put on Mod Night, you wrote a little something about having been around the ECB for a while and wanting to be on a team, Harold team. And now that you're on a Mod team, it was sort of like a, I don't know, it was like a positive sort of gratitude essay. Do you remember this?
Was it, not when I got on Asses? Maybe it was when I auditioned for the like 4th or 5th time and didn't get on? I remember writing a post about how like I was okay with failing and feeling like I had failed.
That's what I want you to talk about. So whatever that was.
Okay. So each time I auditioned and didn't get on, it felt a little different. The first time it was like, cool, I auditioned. Now I know what it's like to be in that room. Next time I'll be a little more ready for that room. I would love to get on, but I understand why I didn't, because I'm really new at this. And like the second and third times I auditioned, a lot of my friends were literally telling me that I was going to get on a team, as if they had read my fortune cookie, or as if someone had told them, Benjamin's going to be on a Herald team. Benjamin's going to be on a Herald team. And people would say, dude, you're going to get on. And I would say, oh, thanks. I really appreciate that. And no matter how much you try not to think about that or believe it, you do. You instantly do. As soon right. as like two people say you're going to get on, you now believe that you're going to get on. And then when I didn't get on, I was pretty crushed. Like the second and third times I didn't get on. Like just confused and thinking, am I not good at it? Am I good at it? But Anthony King, who was artistic director at the time, like, does he have something against me? Or is there something that I'm, that's preventing me from achieving this that I'm completely unaware of? And it can make you a little paranoid.
Sure.
And then I think the fourth time was when I said, well, maybe that means it's not going to happen. And it's not that I haven't auditioned enough or I haven't gotten good enough. It's just, I'm somehow outside of an invisible circle of people who, by the time they die, will have accomplished this thing. Mm-hmm. Some people do and some people don't. And I'm maybe just not one of the people who will get on Herald Night.
Right.
For whatever reason. And at that point I decided, well, if that's the case, then I'm going to have to be not okay with it, but I'm going to have to not fight it, because you can't fight something that's just not happening. Right. So at that point I decided, well, I can still have a really like happy life as a human being, because for a while you don't think you can,
right?
Until you get that thing you really want and you think that you need.
Mm-hmm.
You think, unless I get this, I will be unhappy for the rest of my life. And so I decided to accept that in one area I would be unhappy for the rest of my life. And that's when I wrote a post about like accepting that it was a failure, and that I had failed to accomplish a goal, and that if I never accomplished it, then for my whole life I would continue to consider it a failure. Because I had seen people fail to get on a Herald team and try to cut off the part of them that cared about it or wanted it, and convince them that they didn't want it, or that the system was bogus, or that, yeah, I'm not kissing up to the right person, and I'm not going to do that. And only people who do that get that, or like convince themselves that it's just a clique of people who get given that thing, or that they're literally too good for it. Like, they want me to play by their rules. Like,
right.
See, people can find a way to convince themselves why they hadn't gotten it. And I wasn't able to do that because I thought the Herald Night was great. I thought that great people were being put on. I listen to Anthony King's podcast with you guys, which there's a few different podcasts that are kind of like that I've listened to a couple times or more. And Anthony's one of them, where he talked about like how he decides to put shows together and stuff. And I thought, well, here's an honest guy who's like trying really hard to put good people on teams, and he hasn't put me on a team. There's nothing I can do about that.
Yeah.
So I just said, well, I guess I failed. But by that time I was on Onassis, and Onassis was incredibly fun. And I thought, well, maybe improv will just not be my thing.
Mm-hmm.
Sketch will be my thing.
But then you did get one other audition. Right?
Then the next time I auditioned, the fifth time I got on.
And did you go into it any differently into that fifth audition?
Definitely. I still really want it, but I didn't need it as much.
Hmm.
I was like, this would be great if I got this, but right. I'm really busy with Onassis. We're doing a lot of stuff, and it's really rewarding. And if I did it, actually, I found several times that I found that if you want this thing, it's really hard to get it if that's the only thing you want. But if you start getting distracted, it's actually like in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, you fly by missing the ground. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like you have to jump or fall, and then if at the last second you're about to hit the ground, you get distracted by something.
Right.
And you miss the ground. I feel that way. Like, whenever you want something really bad, you're focusing on it too much, but then you're like, you know what, maybe actually I want to do sketch instead. And you start doing it, and the part of your brain that was wanting it so bad that it caused you to be anxious and therefore fuck it up all the time is now distracted by something else. And it's like, oh, Herald auditions. Yeah. I'll do Herald auditions, of course. And then you're not thinking about it as much, and then you like a better job.
Interesting. Yeah. Because that's always something that I,
you know, I mean, it can't be helped, but like, I fear for people who think like that. I fear that people are thinking like that, that it's like, well, it's only a certain type of person or number. There's like some secret inner circle of people that get put on teams, or like you have to kiss a certain amount of ass, or you have to like do this or that, which is like, that couldn't be any less true.
Yeah.
It's like the best people at when they're ready, like,
yeah,
the best people at the right times get on teams. And there's no, like, I've seen people like you and plenty of other people, whether it's Harold teams or mod teams or whatever, like, keep auditioning, and then suddenly it's like, oh, now you're great.
You know? Because it's always whenever auditions happen and like there's a shakeup and people get placed on, sometimes there'll be like the ID will have some note where they say, remember, there's just not enough slots for all the good people. And then if you didn't get on, you think, yeah, but you are implying that the best 64 improvisers in New York City are getting on, and I didn't get on. Therefore, you are indirectly telling me that I'm not as good as those people.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't help but think that, no matter how much you try not to have that mindset.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
That's your conclusion, and that's like always going to be disheartening.
Yeah.
And it's hard. It's always hard.
Yeah. This is something that I wanted to say. We had like an all theater meeting yesterday with like all the performers and writers and people who run shows. And we actually talked about this. Nate and Alex Sittis and I talked about this the other day, because we were talking about the Kennedy assassination. And I was saying, this is about to take a
John F. Kennedy?
Yeah.
You're talking to a guy from a team called Onassis.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's about to take a hard left political turn.
And you were on
the fucking Kennedy. I'm surprised.
That's right. Yeah. I feel like I believe in conspiracy theories less since getting this job.
Okay.
Because, like, you know, you talking about stuff like that where it's like, oh, only a certain, you know, you have to do a certain amount of this, or only a certain kind of people, you know. Like, I think it's easy to get. And I know I had this for a while in certain senses. It's easy to get this idea that somehow the system is against you in some way. And I know from doing this job, like, I do not have the time or the energy to be against people. Like, we don't have that kind of time or energy to be like, all right, well, this certain person or group of people, we will railroad for the rest of their time here.
Yeah, like, we've all agreed that they're blacklisted and they'll never find out.
Right.
And they will always spin their wheels, and we will just not put them out of their misery by telling them, we've decided you'll never do anything here.
Right. Even if we made that decision, I would forget the next day who we were talking about.
Then you see them do a really funny show and like it gets a run, or they get on a team or whatever. Like that's happened. People who either think, well, this is never going to happen for me, and then they get on, or, you know, things along those lines where you can see that it was never written in stone from the beginning. It's always flexible.
Yeah.
But I've also found that whatever you're doing, if you've given yourself license to think that way,
mm-hmm.
you will think that way your entire life.
Absolutely.
When you get to the next level, you'll think, why didn't I get a pilot picked up? Why didn't I get cast in this new whatever, et cetera, et cetera. And you'll think that way.
I think about that all the time. I think that's a really important point.
Like,
you will, it's always your external circumstances will never change your internal thinking.
Even though there are definitely some cases in which there is a click.
Sure.
It is absolutely true that you have to kiss up to get something.
Yeah.
But if you've allowed yourself to get in that mindset, you'll see it where it doesn't happen. And also, even in that circumstance, having the mindset that you must work hard is the better mindset to have, even if you're wrong.
Right.
Like, I think it's good to teach your kids that hard work gets you ahead, even when it's not true. When it's clearly not true.
Anything else, Will?
Yes. May I do a couple of just silly speed round questions with Benjamin?
Sure, sure, sure.
I know we're over time, right, Saifa?
I have an Islanders game to get to.
What time is it right now? How much time I got?
That's all right. Go ahead.
Give me a short time limit.
5 minutes.
Oh, I got more than enough. I don't have 5 minutes for this stuff.
All right. Three minutes.
I'm going to give you either or choices. No, I'm going to do it like this. You're going to have to fill in the blank specifics, improv scenes.
Okay.
I'll give you an example. You're in an improv scene. You're a head librarian. You have to name yourself. What's your name?
Jonathan.
You work for the mafia. What's your job within the mafia? Different scene.
I protect people.
Give me your specific role in the organization.
Like, I accompany.
What are your responsibilities?
When there's a deal going down or anything happening, I'm standing by and watching it happen, and I'm armed, but I'm not actively threatening anybody. I'm just watching it happen to make sure that nothing bad happens.
You're a runaway bride at the airport. What country are you going to?
Yugoslavia.
You're obsessed with a member of the royal family of England. Which one?
Harry.
Why?
His name just popped in my head.
You locked yourself in the bathroom at a party.
Oh, did you mean why? Like I should have justified it?
Yeah, but it didn't matter. I like that justification better. I like that the character was obsessed with his name just popped in his head. Your character's trapped himself in the bathroom for an hour. Why did he do at a party? Why did he do it?
Has locked himself. I'm just scared. I'm scared.
Scared of the party?
Yeah, everybody seems to know each other and I don't have anything to say, so if I go up to them, what am I going to say?
I'm going to give you some either ors.
Okay.
Which one feels funnier to you? Without thinking about it too much, I kind of just go like on a gut feel, like without condensed milk or evaporated milk?
Condensed.
Desert or ocean?
Desert.
Moon or Ernest Borgnine?
Moon.
Warm.
I've heard you say Ernest Borgnine before.
Yeah, I think he's a funny name.
That is a funny name.
The name is funny? Okay.
He's funny. His face is funny.
Sure.
He makes me laugh. And he's nice and happy. Ernest Borgnine or James Cagney?
Cagney.
Warm or lukewarm?
Depends.
You got to pick. Which one's funnier?
Warm. Because I think lukewarm sounds like it's trying. Like if you said the phrase lukewarm, uh-huh. you're trying to make a joke. You.
Minneapolis or Kansas City, Missouri?
Minneapolis.
Minneapolis or Albany?
Albany.
Albany or John Cougar Mellencamp?
Albany. Mellencamp, I feel the same way about.
Albany or John Cougar?
It's still Albany.
Albany or the North Atlantic Ocean?
Albany.
Albany or the Atlantic Ocean? I'm figuring this out.
Albany.
What are you figuring out exactly?
Benjamin Apple. Albany or Sacramento?
Albany.
Albany or Cleveland?
Albany by a long shot.
Albany or?
Albany is funny to me because it doesn't sound funny.
I know. I'm getting there.
Okay.
Albany or Winnipeg?
Albany again.
Albany or Manitoba?
Albany.
Albany or
You're
Toronto?
You're saying all these silly, ridiculous like names that shouldn't exist.
Albany or Toronto?
Albany.
Albany or Hartford?
Albany.
Albany or... Harrisburg?
Albany.
Okay, I'm done.
What's your conclusion?
There's a certain degree of specificity that offends him.
What do you mean?
It has to be like specific, but on the like closer... If there's like a 0 to 10 level of specificity, you like 4.
I don't think it's specificity. I think that you picked a lot of names that are funny sounding because of the rhythm of the consonants and vowels. Mm-hmm. I think Albany is a very real mm-hmm. town with no stereotypes attached to it. If mm-hmm. someone said, I'm going to Albany this weekend, nobody would laugh because of how it sounds. Mm-hmm. They might laugh because you made a choice. Mm-hmm. But if you said Winnipeg...
Yeah, Winnipeg definitely sounds silly.
Or most of those other things.
Hartford?
I think Hartford... I hesitated there for a second because it was coming close.
Harrisburg?
Harrisburg sounds like you're trying to pick something in the middle of nowhere, I feel.
No more than Albany.
I like Albany. See, I think it has a good round sound to it.
The cities.
Either way, you owe Will $300.
Did I lose?
Yeah.
No, you didn't lose.
I mean, you didn't lose. You had a very specific psychological service.
I might not be able
performed.
To articulate, but I have a sense of it.
Okay.
All right. Let's wrap this up, huh?
Yeah, that's good. Thank you, Benjamin.
Benjamin, this is great. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
I really enjoyed this conversation.
Me too.
Sypha disagrees.
No, his podcast is almost longer than mine.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. All right.
Fix that in there.
All right. Well, we better stop it now margin. Before it becomes longer than yours.
Cut it out.
All right. Benjamin, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
That must free.